Don't be daunted when I tell you that this morning we're going to be going through 4 chapters of Joshua. Although we have our nosh in the room, we are not going to be serving it mid-sermon, but instead we are going to just go through this in a fairly rapid pace, not verse by verse as we usually do, because what this is all about is it's about the dividing of the land of Canaan. And it's going to go through all the different tribes and all the different places where they are. So rather than go through this list of tens of thousands of cities, and now that Eddie's got his overhead all fixed up, I'm going to come and disrupt it for us. Alright, so back to this map again. And we've got here the division of the land according to this particular author. I have said before that this varies back and forth from, thank you, author to author, because we don't know exactly where a lot of these things are, a lot of these cities are. We do, of course, know where the Jordan River is. That's easy. But some of these other cities, we don't quite know where they wound up. But in general, this particular author has the tribe of Manasseh spread across the Jordan River. Others bring the border of Zebulun and Issachar down farther and have Manasseh kind of be a dogleg over. So bear that in mind, that this does vary from place to place. But in general, we have Judah down at the bottom. I think this author is probably wrong in that most other authors extend Judah all the way to the Mediterranean. Simeon looks like it's just a chunk out of Judah. However, a commentator that I tend to trust as knowing what he's doing believes that Simeon, rather than being an explicit area within Judah, was merely distributed around in Judah, because Simeon was kind of like an afterthought in all of this, and so they most likely just got some cities within Judah, and thus just fulfilling the prophecy of Jacob towards Simeon and his descendants that they would be scattered about in Israel. Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh, they were the tribes who had decided that they liked the land on the east bank of the Jordan River better than the west bank, because the territory was better for their flocks. They wound up over there. Up top, we had Asher, Naphtali, Zebulun, and Issachar. Opinions differ as to how far up they were. They had the northern part. Ephraim was a little bit down from Manasseh. Dan was over by the coast. Benjamin pretty much got really absorbed into Judah later on. So when you talk about the kingdom of Judah, you're really talking about the kingdom of Judah and Benjamin. It's really the rest of these tribes that then became the northern kingdom and wound up being taken into captivity. Although it's an open question whatever happened to Gad and Reuben, because even later on in the history of Israel, the border of both Israel and Judah became the Jordan River. So it's questionable whatever happened to those other tribes. And then Simeon just kind of disappeared from sight as far as a separate territory. And Judah had all his southern territory. I don't remember where Jerusalem wound up, whether it really was in Judah or in Benjamin. I think there's some doubt as to where it was, where Benjamin, territory of Benjamin was. So that's the basic outline that is going to be gone through in painstaking detail. The reason why it's being gone through in painstaking detail is because it's really a deed. You're partitioning a land like you would partition a parcel of real estate development. It sounds very much like a surveyor's document. If you've ever read, like you own a home and you read the deed to your home, it will say, you know, going such and such a distance and then turning to such and such a direction, proceeding so and so many feet and back again. Even old document I have for a farm there, they measured things in chains and stones, which is, we won't go there. But that's the same idea. You were portioning a land like you portion any other kind of real estate. And so this is going to go through this in excruciating detail. And that's why we could read through it. But to us, in our day, it is a series of unpronounceable cities, a long series of it. Most Bibles do have a map similar to that in the back. I think the Bibles that we have in the congregation is either plate 2 or plate 3. Mine, I think, is in, or map 2, map 3. I think mine is map 4. I think it's map 2 or 3 in the Bibles that you have. I think in this particular map, in the Bibles that you have, they do have Manasseh being a little bit of a dogleg across the Jordan. It's not straight across, but it goes down a little bit. But there are some other things we can look at in this passage other than apportioning land. So let's start in Joshua 16, and they're going to go tribe by tribe. In chapter 16, it's the sons of Joseph. And down in verse 4, the sons of Joseph were Manasseh and Ephraim. And it's going to go through the borders from Manasseh and Ephraim. Those are the two sons of Joseph. And this is when you get down to verse 10 of chapter 16, something very interesting is said. But they did not drive out the Canaanites who lived in Gezer. The Canaanites live in the midst of Ephraim to this day, and they became forced laborers. Okay, that should raise a red flag in your head. So continue on. We'll get back to that thought. Hold that thought, as you would say. Joshua chapter 17, verse 1. Lot for the tribe of Manasseh, for he was the firstborn of Joseph. And down in verse 3 of chapter 17. Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, had no sons, only daughters. These are the names of his daughters: Mahlah and Noah, Hoglah, Milcah, and Tirzah. Okay, and this is actually something that happened before with Moses. You had two sons here, and really this is that whole clan who should have been assigned a territory. Now, since it was only daughters, by the rules that they went by, theoretically that whole side shouldn't have gotten anything. But Moses was the one who gave them permission. In verse 5, thus there fell 10 portions to Manasseh, besides the land of Gilead and Bashan, which is beyond the Jordan, because the daughters of Manasseh received an inheritance among his sons, and the land of Gilead belonged to the rest of the sons of Manasseh. So, because Manasseh was the firstborn of Joseph, and because the daughters got an inheritance, that's probably why Simeon got left out in the end. Because this was that extra portion. Because you might scratch your head and say, well, wait a minute, why at the end in Simeon were they scrambling to find a place for Simeon? Didn't they in the beginning set aside the right number? I mean, couldn't they count? They probably counted. But then in the middle of it, they decided that Manasseh got a double portion because he was the first son of Joseph. And so that's why he wound up with a portion across the Jordan on one side and on the other side also. Okay. And the exact detail. These things are given. Don't think that the description of these things were so vague that we can't draw them on a map. The descriptions were absolutely accurate. The problem is we no longer know where the landmarks are. It's like if somebody gave a description of your property using Indian villages in Maryland 200 years ago, they would have been exact in that time if you knew where the villages were. But since we don't know where the villages were exactly, we couldn't tell where the territories were. And that's why in these lists of things, it's funny, one of the commentators I read is Mikhail and Delish, and the two of them talk about, sometimes they argue with other commentators in their commentary about where certain places are. And they'll say, well, this particular person thinks that this particular village is now at this site, but I believe that it's at this site for the following reasons, but so-and-so disagrees with me, and he thinks it's at this other site, and so you know, that's why it's the maps vary. Verse 14 of chapter 17. The sons of Joseph spoke to Joshua, saying, why have you given me only one lot and one portion for an inheritance, since I am a numerous people whom the Lord has thus far blessed? Well, actually, they didn't have as many people as some of the other tribes. The census later on, Ephraim numbered only 32,500, Manasseh 52,700 at the second census in the time of Moses in the chapter in Numbers, and therefore Ephraim and half Manasseh together did not amount to more than 58,000 or 59,000, as this tribe and a half were not so strong as Judah with its 76,500, and were even weaker than Dan with its 64,400, or Issachar with its 64,300 men. So they may think they were big and blessed, but they weren't as big as many of the other tribes. So as a result, their claim had no basis. And even if you look at the history of Israel from there on forward, you don't see Ephraim and Manasseh playing a leadership role in it, despite the things that Jacob would have wished for the sons of Joseph. Still, going forward, they didn't have that role of leadership. That role of leadership fell definitely to Judah, and to some from Benjamin in the north, but not really from Judah. Joshua's response I like in verse 15. Joshua said to them, if you are a numerous people, go up to the forest and clear a place for yourself there in the land of the Perizzites and of the Rephaim, since the hill country of Ephraim is too narrow for you. In other words, you got room to grow. All you got to do is get off your tukuses and go do something. Go clear the forest, drive out the Canaanites, and you'll have plenty of room. Verse 16, the sons of Joseph said, the hill country is not enough for us, and all the Canaanites live in the valley and land have chariots of iron, both those who are in Beth Shean and its towns and those who are in the valley of Jezreel. So it's too hard for me. We can't do it. If you look at our Haftorah reading from this morning, in the book of Judges, chapter 4, that's describing what God could do with those iron chariots. He took them out. It was no trouble at all. Just wiped them out. All it took was some muddy ground, and they were neutralized. Now they became just funny-looking sculpture in the valley instead of chariots, because they were stuck in place. Verse 17, Joshua spoke to the house of Joseph, to Ephraim and Manasseh, saying, you are a numerous people and have great power. You shall not have one lot only, but the hill country shall be yours. For though it is a forest, you shall clear it, and its farthest border, to its farthest border it shall be yours. You shall drive out the Canaanites, even though they have chariots of iron and though they are strong. Yep. I don't remember in Judges chapter 4 who the tribes were. I guess it was the Ephraimites who did. It was in the tribe of Ephraim, but the ones who actually drew out the Canaanites were not the sons of Ephraim and Manasseh, but as we saw in the Torah portion, those who went up against the chariots were Zebulun and Naphtali. Like I said, Ephraim and Manasseh, despite what Jacob would have liked for those tribes, never really had that leadership role, even though here they had that opportunity to do it. So that kind of tells you something. That's another red flag, right? They're supposed to drive out all the Canaanites. First thing I read was that there was a group of Canaanites that they left as servants. Now they have another group they don't even want to go up against at all. Chapter 18. Then the whole congregation of the sons of Israel assembled at Shiloh and set up the tent of meeting there, and the land was subdued before them. Chapter 18, verse 2. There remained among the sons of Israel seven tribes who had not divided their inheritance. So Joshua said to the sons of Israel, how long will you put off entering to take possession of the land which the Lord, the God of your fathers, has given you? So in other words, there's seven tribes just weren't even interested. and taking on the role that God had set for them. They would rather just sit in camp. They're having plenty of fun right where they were. Taking on their inheritance, that was hard. Sitting around camp, no problem. So Joshua said, look, it's time. Get over here, let's survey the land, and we're going to divide it up. So he sent out men from each tribe so that they could survey, divide the land. Verse 5, they were going to divide the new portion of land into seven portions and bring the description, leaving the Levites out. So these men went out, they surveyed the land. Verse 11, Benjamin was allotted first to the north of Judah. And I'm just looking to see down at towards the bottom. It did not include Jerusalem, verse 16. It just kind of passed around the slope below Jerusalem, but not including Jerusalem itself. And all the different cities, all the different places. And that was going to be the inheritance of Benjamin. All right, chapter 19. Simeon, tribe of the sons of Simeon, and the inheritance was in the midst of the inheritance of the sons of Judah. That still mystifies me. I don't have a good explanation for that, because they surveyed the land. They could have just made other places smaller, but they didn't. Instead, they looked at the tribe of Judah and said, whoa, you got too much. Maybe they surveyed and said, well, the land isn't as big as we thought it was. So instead, they allotted land within Judah, which was probably not contiguous land. In verse 9, the inheritance of the sons of Simeon was taken from the portion of the sons of Judah, for the share of the sons of Judah was too large for them. The sons of Simeon received an inheritance in the midst of Judah's inheritance. So why did they take them that long to find out? Maybe after they'd surveyed the land, it wasn't as big as they thought it was, or maybe it wasn't as inhabitable as they thought it was. There might have been more mountains and other things in there, more desolation. So they said, well, we got to split up the inheritance of Judah. So they gave it to Simeon. Then to Zebulun in verse 10. And then down in Issachar, down in 23, verse 23. Then in verse 32 of Naphtali. And all the different cities. And then verse 40, tribes of Dan. And then finally in verse 48 of chapter 19, or I'm sorry, in 49, chapter 19, then they gave an inheritance especially to Joshua. They gave him the city for which he asked, Timnath-Serah, in the hill country of Ephraim. So he built the city and settled in it. These are the inheritances of Eleazar the priest and Joshua the son of Nun, and the heads of the households of the tribes of the sons of Israel distributed by lot in Shiloh before the Lord at the doorway of the tent of meeting. So they finished dividing the land. So now they divided the land and they took it. They occupied the land. So they accomplished 90% of the task. But they left some important things undone. They did not drive out the Canaanites. Not all of them. They drove out enough of them so that they could make room for themselves. They could lay claim to it. But they didn't drive out all of them. Turn me to Judges chapter 2. That kind of gives you a flavor of what's about to happen. Judges happened right after Joshua. But this also summarizes some things. Now the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim, and he said, I brought you up out of Egypt and led you into the land which I have sworn to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you. And as for you, you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall tear down their altars. But you have not obeyed me. What is this you have done? Therefore I also said, I will not drive them out before you, but they will become as thorns in your sides, and their gods will be a snare to you. The angel of the Lord spoke these words to all the sons of Israel. The people lifted up their voices and wept. So they named that place Bochim, and there they sacrificed to the Lord. When Joshua had dismissed the people, the sons of Israel went each to his inheritance to possess the land. The people served the Lord all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the elders who survived Joshua, who had seen all the great work of the Lord which he had done for Israel. And Joshua, son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110. They buried him in the territory of his inheritance at Timnath-Heres in the hill country of Ephraim, north of Mount Gaash. All that generation also were gathered to their fathers, and there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord, nor yet the work which he had done for Israel. And the sons of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals, and they forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt, and followed other gods from among the gods of the peoples who were around them, and bowed themselves down to them. Thus they provoked the Lord to anger. So they forsook the Lord and served Baal and the Asherah. The anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he gave them into the hands of plunderers who plundered them, and he sold them into the hands of their enemies around them, so that they could no longer stand before their enemies. Wherever they went, the hand of the Lord was against them for evil, as the Lord had spoken, and as the Lord had spoken to them, had sworn to them, so that they were severely distressed. The Lord raised up judges who delivered them from the hands of those who plundered them, yet they did not listen to their judges, for they played the harlot after other gods and bowed themselves down to them. They turned aside quickly from the way in which their fathers had walked, and obeying the commandments of the Lord, they did not do as their fathers. So the plan was that they would go forth in the power of God and drive out and destroy the Canaanites and their culture and their religion, because God said, this has got to go. Instead, when Israel hit the 90% mark, they said, we're done. We're done. It's good enough. That's a great trap we all fall into in our walk with God. To go forward in the power of God, that God takes us through the battle, and now we're at the other side, and all that's left to do is the cleaning up, the odds and ends. And we look and survey that great vista that God has provided for us, that's there for the taking. We just have to march down the mountain, and we say, nah, too much trouble. I think I'll just stay here. It's kind of nice here. Not as good as where God was taking me, but I like this place. I'll stick around here. I don't need to go any farther. God has provided this wonderful thing for us. He has provided His commandments. And instead of going forth boldly, we say, okay, I'm done. Thank you, God, for driving me this far, but I'll walk from here. As a matter of fact, I've decided I'm not even going to walk in your direction. I've decided that since you brought me this far, I'll walk off that direction because I think that's going to be comfortable. There's a tree there I can sit down under and nothing bad's going to happen. That's what they did. And it just upset God very much because He had done so very much to get them to the place where they would be established in the land and drive out the Canaanites and be a people dedicated to Him that He could raise up as a testimony to the nations all around. I mean, that was the plan. You look at all the things and say, well, why would God promise to bless Israel the way He promised? Well, they were supposed to be blessed to be a blessing to all those around. They're supposed to be a testimony of what God could do, of what a pure and obedient people could accomplish in the power of God. Instead, they said, nah, that's okay. We're good. We're good. And how many times we do that with God? And He's got this plan for us. He's got this accomplishment for us, and we just get that stirring, that zeal that God places in us when we're in His presence in the mountain, and He stirs us forward, and we go forth in His mighty power, and we win victories. And then finally, we're done with the last battle, and now all that we have to do is walk forward. Nah, don't feel like it. I've done enough battling for today. I think I'll just sit here. Or maybe I'll just go back a little ways. I mean, yeah, okay, God, that's great. We did it together and you showed we could do it. Wonderful. Now that we're done, though, I'm going back that way. Because it's safer back there. And you brought me out here and you showed me and great work, God. Now I'm going home. Now I'm going back. God's like, how could you? It's like, I bet you flitter. It's like you do everything you can to help someone. It's like you know, in our day, it's like you provide somebody an apartment, a place to live, and a good start, and you walk away and you say, ah, that's great. I've done all this, and I've really done what's expected, and gone far beyond, and you hear a month later that they got evicted for trashing the place and, you know, holding wild parties at night and annoying the neighbors and cussing out the landlord, and you just bang your head against the side of the table thinking, why did I even bother? Well, God was like that with the children of Israel because he had done all this for them. He'd set it all up. And they said, no, thank you. Sometimes in our lives, God sets it all up, and then we say, no, thank you. We really got to watch that. I mean, you know, you joke about that in home improvements. You know, doing remodeling around the house. Oftentimes, you got to also watch out for the 90% is done rule. You know, the stairs are done, but someday you'll get around to putting the railing up, or, you know, the wall's up, and it's spackled, and someday you'll get around to painting it. And 90% equals done. Not in obeying God. 90% doesn't equal done. 99% doesn't equal done. 99.99% doesn't equal done. 99. Oh, I could go on all afternoon. That doesn't equal done. You have to get to 100% to be done. And when God tells us to do something or not to do something and stirs us up and empowers us to do something, then ride the wave. I mean, go with God's power. When he gets you moving, just go with it. And don't stop. Don't turn back. Don't think about where, you know, what's happening. Just kind of go. You know, we joke sometimes about close your eyes and pray. Not recommended when you're driving, but sometimes in life, when God has got you moving and things are just happening, just close your eyes and pray. Just keep moving with God. Don't, you know, it's like when you're in the race and you're out front and you're really, you know, just smoking the rest of the competition. That's not the time to say, oh, I think I'll stop and tie my shoes. You just keep going. Keep moving in God's power. It's not a time to be scared. It's not a time to look back. It's not a time to wonder. Just keep moving. Obeying God. Walking in his presence. Having that kind of life that testifies to God's power. It's like, how in the world can we be testimony to how wonderful life in Yeshua is if what we portray to other people is how miserable our life is and how powerless we are, instead of really talking about the wonderful things, the things that God has empowered us to do, the places God has taken us, the challenges that he's allowed us to triumph over, the iron chariots in our own lives, the things that we thought were absolutely impossible. It's sort of like, you know, almost like the cartoon where we duck our heads and cover our ears and just wait for that anvil to hit. And instead, it's like nothing happens. You're kind of looking around, open one eye, look around, open the other eye, and nothing happens because God catches the anvil. And we think there's just no way that anybody could have helped us. And said, God not only helps us, but he triumphs magnificently in our own lives. And some people say, oh, I've never experienced that. Well, you never experience that if you turn back at the first leg of the journey. If you don't even follow through, if you didn't even, you know, the three steps out of Egypt, you know, in our Torah portion from Exodus 14, it's like some people say, oh, I've never seen God's power work in my life. Well, three steps out of Egypt, you turn back. You never even made it all the way to the Red Sea to see God's power. You never, after that, you never made it to the land of Canaan to see God working mightily and conquering it. You turn right back. Maybe you saw a snake or a scorpion. You say, oh, that's it. I'm not going any further. And you headed back. Sometimes as believers, I've seen people who got spooked and all sorts of things. Part of it is this name it, claim it stuff that says that you have to really feel God's blessing, that you have to really, you know, that anything God asks you to do, it's like clear sailing, that you never have any trouble, any problems, everything's always, you just are so happy with the way everything's going that you put yourself to sleep laughing every night when God has set something for you to do. And it's not like that. It's hard. Even though we look at Joshua's victory and the victory that they accomplished, it was hard. But yet it was satisfying at the end of the day. So we keep moving. Keep moving in the power of God. We don't turn back. We don't doubt. And we finish the job. Paul could say that I have finished the course in his death, that he has completed the race. How wonderful it is when a believer on his deathbed can say, I did it. God set me aside and set a task for me to do, and I did it. I accomplished it. How terrible instead it would be to say, oh, God set me this task that I knew I ought to be doing, but I never bothered. I always found excuses. I always found other things to do. I procrastinated. I did everything but what God had said to do. How sad that would be. Obey God. Finish the course. Don't be satisfied with 90%. When God's behind you, when God's Spirit is in your sails, just pull up the anchor and go with God. See where He takes you. Because He takes you into amazing places. Sometimes they're challenging places. I almost said scary places, but challenging places. But they're always wonderful places. And the journey is always worth it. Let's pray. Dearest God and Father, forgive us for the times that we turn back and we're satisfied with 90%, sometimes 80%, sometimes 50%, sometimes 10%, instead of just following the course, trusting You, obeying You for whatever happened, for never giving up, never turning back, but cooperating with You and accomplishing Your great plan in our lives, that we might bring You great glory and raise up that mighty name of Yeshua, our Messiah and coming King. Amen.